Police and people of color. It's a combination that has been in the news constantly over the last couple of years, often with white cop injuring or killing black suspect. We keep struggling to understand the events of the real world. Today's guests take the subject and situations into fiction, young adult fiction specifically. Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley are the authors of the novel All American Boys. The central event, white cop beats black teen. But since it's fiction, we can know more about the motivations and mistakes of the characters. Let's meet the authors. Jason Reynolds says he's crazy about stories. He's the author of When I Was the Greatest and The Boy in the Black Suit. Jason, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jeff.
You bet. Brendan Kiley is a high school teacher as well as a writer. His debut novel is The Gospel of Winter, now published in several languages. I should point out that All American Boys is already a top seller at Amazon. So thank you to both of you, Brendan, for being here today.
Yeah, so glad to be here, Jeff. Thanks so much.
So tell us, how did each of you come to write for YA audiences? Go ahead, Brendan.
Actually, so I was a teacher, right? And I worked in schools for, I worked in a school for 10 years. And I felt like the faces that I saw each morning looked up at me, and they were filled with hope, and they inspired me, and I wanted to turn around and inspire them. So writing for young people is kind of a dream come true. Although I have to say, when you write for young people, I think you're also writing for adults, and so for me, it's I'm writing for both, and I love it.
Jason, how about you? Why the YA field?
Well, I think for me, I agree with Brendan in terms of making sure that, I mean, you just write your stories and whoever picks them up, picks them up. But I will say, as a young person who grew up not feeling like he saw any representation of himself in literature during the 80s and the 90s, I am constantly thinking about the young people who are growing up in the neighborhoods like I grew up in who hopefully won't have to feel that way if I do my necessary job, right? If I do what I do, and along with other writers who are doing this kind of work, then those kids don't have to grow up like I did without any representation of themselves in literature.
That's a tough situation. Tell us a little more about that. So you were looking through everything you get your hands on and weren't finding any characters like yourself in any of the fiction?
For sure. I mean, in the 80s, it's weird. There's a strange gap. It's like it's almost like a 20-year gap between 1980 and basically 1999, where other than Walter Dean Myers, there weren't many books written with young people in mind about young people, especially young people of color, growing up in the city environment, dealing with some of the harsh realities of life, right? So if we were being taught anything about ourselves as a young black boy, I was being taught things that were happening in the 60s, the 50s, the 40s, the 30s, the 20s, in America, or the 1800s when it comes to slavery. But there were no contemporary tales about life in the 80s. There were no, hip-hop has not been mentioned in any books during that generation. Crack cocaine, it was not mentioned. HIV, those are the three major movements in poor communities all over this country, and there's no documentation in them in literature for young people.
Wow. Was it a conscious decision, or just like a marketing thing, like they didn't think anybody would buy it, or what?
You know, that I do not know. I'm willing to bet that, you know, I mean, the industry suffers from diversity issues, and it always has. And I think that was just a moment where there was a lull, there was a gap. Now, granted, on the adult side, in the 90s, there was a boom, right? I mean, that's when you had sort of like You're Waiting to Exhale, and you had Elin Harris and Eric Jerome Dickey and all these people who were writing very, very, very contemporary tales about black life on the adult side. But it was just on the young adult side that other than Walter Dean Myers, there was very few, if anybody else doing it the way he was doing it.
Why is it called YA and not teen? Do you know that, Brendan?
You know, I don't think I have a definite answer for you there, other than I think young adult spans a wide range of teen readers in also into their young 20s. And so young adult is a readership that that spans probably outside of the teen years. If you go into Barnes & Noble, you will see, the categories actually are marked teen. They'll say what teens are reading today or new teen fiction. But those are just the categories at Barnes & Noble. The overall publishing category of young adult, especially now, because as we know, reading is actually going up in the 25 to 35 set, and they're reading quite a bit of young adult literature. We were on a panel about a month ago, and a literary agent quoted the figure that 80% of young adult fiction is purchased by adults for adults. Obviously, that includes the big bestsellers like the Harry Potter series and Twilights and Divergence and whatnot. But it also includes work like ours, which is realistic fiction.
That makes sense that you want to call it young adult, because if an adult's buying it, they wouldn't want to have to sneak it out in a brown paper bag because, you know, it says teen on it or something.
That's right.
Right. So how did this project come about, Jason?
Well, Brendan and I were on tour together last year for other books that we had written. Simon and Schuster paired us up. We did not know each other. We were strangers. And they were doing this sort of test run of this thing they call the Gentleman's Tour, where they send male writers out together to tour the country. And this came shortly after the wake of the George Zimmerman verdict in the Trayvon Martin case. And so here I am sort of feeling frustrated and defeated and angry. I'm dealing with my mother's emotions. You know, she's crying about what's going on. And I'm on tour with a stranger. And not only is he a stranger, but he's a stranger from a community outside of my own. And so there was a bit of a reticence in terms of having that discussion. But I felt like I needed to talk to somebody about it. And eventually it came up, and fate would have it that Brendan was as upset and as frustrated and as angry as I was. And so we started to have that discussion. And as we continued to tour, the incidents continued to happen. And the more they happened, the further down that rabbit hole we went. And all the way up until August, when the unfortunate incident with Michael Brown and Ferguson happened, and I think that was the final straw in which Brendan came to me and he said, look, man, we have to do something. That was sort of the impetus for All American Boys.
So already in progress by the time that the Michael Brown shooting happened in Ferguson.
It was in progress psychologically, uh-huh. But we hadn't put it on the page yet. We had just started to, after Michael Brown died, that's when it was like, you know what, let's really focus and dive into this thing.
All right.
I mean, what was happening was it was the building of a friendship, and I think that's what makes the partnership of this novel what it is. We're building a friendship over a number of months, and it was that friendship that gave us the basis to experiment and try to tackle this novel.
All right, much more to talk about with Brendan Kiely and Jason Reynolds. Their book together is All American Boys. They alternate chapters. It's about the about a white cop beating a black teen and all the events that surround that. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more with Jason and Brendan and you in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today to the authors of the young adult novel All American Boys, which has the central event being the beating of a black teen by a white cop, events all too familiar in the real world, but we can gain greater perspective by getting inside the heads of the people in the fictional piece. Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiely, the co-authors. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We just talked about how the whole process came together when you were on tour promoting other books that you'd already written. Had either of you worked with a partner before in this way?
This is my first time, and it's been the greatest experience of the career so far, so I'm grateful for it. But I'll let Jason tell you, because he's worked on collaborations in the past.
Yeah, I have. My very first book with HarperCollins was a collaborative project with one of my best friends who's an artist. And so it was a little different because we didn't share the same medium. We just sort of did our own thing and combined them and meshed them together. But I love collaborating. I think it's such a different experience. I mean, writing is such a solitary function, and I think when you're doing it with somebody else, it definitely adds a bit of adds some life to it and some excitement to it. I mean, I love collaborating.
There are different voices and perspectives in the book, to be sure, but I mean, how often did you coordinate and discuss? And there must have been at least one master strategy session, I'm thinking, to lay out the plot.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we were first thinking about the book, we sat down and decided we would separately come up with our main characters. So Jason and I, we agreed we were going to work on this project. We knew we were going to work on a project that was coming out of the fire in our bellies after all of the incidents in Ferguson. And we went and we worked on our Rashad and our Quinn, our two separate main characters. We came back about a month later, and we sat down over a few cups of tea and outlined in the most bare bones fashion what it might be like for these two boys after that one moment of violence. That Rashad survives, and it's important to know that he survives the moment, but he's still brutalized. What the days of the week would look like in the 1 week following that moment of violence. And it was the barest bones that was, you know, the kind of outline you write on a little napkin next to your tea mug. And we agreed on that, and we agreed on what the town might look like. And then we went our separate ways. And eventually, you know, Jason would send me a few chapters and I would send him a few chapters. And after we read each other's chapters, we would make sure that if there was a character that, you know, entered both, you know, sides of the story, that that character was a full and fully realized person in both narratives. And other than that, it was a real serendipitous kind of running side by side. In fact, mirroring that famous speech that Martin Luther King gave at Grosse Pointe High School in 1968, when he talked about two Americas living side by side. This is Rashad and Quinn, two all-American boys living side by side in the same town, who go to the same high school, and yet have very, very, very different lives.
Now, the town is Springfield, Massachusetts, is that right?
It's not Springfield, Massachusetts. It's Springfield, and then we don't list the state anywhere. The idea, of course, you know, as many other people have done before, that Springfield is the most commonly used name for a city in the United States. And our point was that this is Springfield, any state.
Like the Simpsons Springfield in that sense.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly.
But a very different kind of Springfield, we should make entirely clear.
That's right. Exactly.
So, if you would, Jason, give us the basic storyline and conflict in the book.
The basic storyline is that Rashad and Quinn are from the same neighborhood. They got the same friends. They go to the same high school, same socioeconomic status. The only thing that's actually different about them is that one is black and one is white. Rashad is an ROTC kid. He's an artist. Quinn is a basketball player and a big brother to his little brother, who he takes care of after the death of his father. It's a Friday night. They're going to the exact same party, to Jill's party. They're stopping at the exact same corner store at the same time. Rashad is stopping to get a bag of chips. Quinn is stopping to ask somebody else to bum some beer for him and his friends. Rashad goes in to get a bag of chips. A lady bumps him. He drops the bag of chips, and the cop assumes and accuses him of stealing and brutalizes him out on the sidewalk. Quinn happens to be standing out there trying to bum his beer. He sees the officer brutalize Rashad. And not only does he see the officer, but he knows the officer, because that officer is, in fact, his father figure, the man who took care of him after his own father passed away. And then they go on their separate ways for the next week. Rashad in the hospital and Quinn back in school and home. And they both have to sort of deal and reckon with what they've both experienced, one as an onlooker and two as a victim.
So the interactions through the course of this week are basically nothing beyond the beating, right?
They actually never interact.
Mm-hmm.
Rashad and Quinn don't interact. They don't know each other, and they, you know, small spoiler, they never know each other. They don't know each other. And that was intentional for us, because I think when we speak of the two Americas, I think we oftentimes speak of the two Americas as if the perfect ending to that story is everybody kumbayaing, and the truth is that that's not always the case.
Yeah.
It's not always the case. More often than not, it's not the case.
So, and in fact, I don't think we need to have that kind of a resolution to think about what forms of resolution we might want in real life. But also, these characters, although they are separate the entire time, thematically, there's something interesting that's similar in that they both have to, as Jason said, reconcile with who they will become. And in a sense, I feel like hopefully this book creates an opportunity for people who might see themselves in either Rashad or Quinn, empathizing with the other side of the story, and vice versa. It becomes a window into one experience and a mirror for another, and a flip-flop in both ways.
Was there any pressure from the publishing company or anybody else to say, oh, come on, they need to at least get to know each other at the end, or, you know, handshake or something like that?
You know, I feel like everyone would expect that to be the case, but I'm incredibly grateful for the third writer, I like to say, of this book, who was our editor. At Simon & Schuster, who I think fully recognized the value of the story that we had laid out and really helped us shape it to become the story we wanted it to be.
Now, both of the characters start out naive about racism, and in the week the book takes place, they both lose the innocence. It seems like it's a bumpier ride for Quinn, although he doesn't have the physical pain to deal with. Quinn's your guy, Brendan, so why don't you take it from there?
Sure. No, I appreciate that question, because I think it's true. I think you know, I, as a white person, it's impossible for me to say I understand racism the way a person of color would understand it. And I think that's what Quinn recognizes right from the get-go as well, is that In effect, he has to begin to recognize the real gravity of racism in his own community and the effects of racism in his own community. And even though he himself is not the perpetrator of violence, how he has benefited from being protected in some way from having to ever really face this kind of psychological violence, this kind of physical violence. And so for him, it's a bumpier ride because it's almost as if he's born 16 years late into thinking about this, and he's just now coming to terms with, what is my role in all of this? You know, I've always thought of myself as a nice guy. I've always thought of myself as the one who's out there doing everything right. But maybe I need to open my eyes a bit wider. Maybe I need to have these difficult conversations with some friends that I can trust. And that's one of the parts of the book that I think I like the most, is that Quinn doesn't process all of this in his head by himself. He's out there in school and on the phone with other friends.
So if you would, Jason, give us an idea of how far Rashad has to travel in his views about race. And I mean, this would have to be a serious setback, obviously.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Rashad's story has a little more to do. It's a little more personal, right? So his story isn't necessarily about race per se, because Rashad has an older brother, and his older brother has made it very clear. He's seen his older brother go to protests. He's watched his older brother sort of fight these fights already. So he's aware of the notion of race. He's aware that these things happen, but it's always different when they happen to you. And I think what he has to realize is he has to sort of deal with all the backlash. I think when we think about police brutality, we usually think about victims who are killed. But the truth is that there are more people who are brutalized and live, and the psychological trauma that follows is something that I really wanted to dig into. I think there's so much fear that's involved. I think there's so much pain, psychological pain, physical pain, of course. I think there's a strange discomfort and frustration and confusion. I think that social media and all of its power also creates a really, I mean, we don't ever think about the fact that victims are human beings, right? That when you hashtag a person, that person is still a human, and that person has to see themselves as a hashtag. And what does that feel like? What does it feel like to turn the TV on and see news pundits giving their opinion about your life? Like, what does that feel like? And I really wanted to tie all those things, and even family expectations, right? And what that means, and having a father who's a police officer, and what that means, and just adding a bunch of complication and nuance to his story. I think the victim story gets hyper distilled, and I wanted to sort of flesh it out and pull the camera back to more of a macro level to show all the nuances and the complexities and the details in that story.
Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley are our guests on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-authors with interleaved chapters of the book All American Boys. It's a young adult novel about a white cop beating a black teen who does survive, and the repercussions for the black teen and the white teen who views the thing, and they actually don't know each other, but these are the viewpoints in the book. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking about the father being a cop for Rashad. Rashad is you know, he gets to know some of the power structure of the world. I mean, he joins ROTC and stuff like that. Although, and I love the writing in this part about I left, you know, like the marching cadence left, got out of there. But so. Rashad is he comes from an interesting place in the world to begin with. I mean, he knows something of discipline and you know, military like structures.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you know, that was important for me. I think that when we think of it's an interesting thing when we think of police brutality cases, and when they give profiles of the people who have been brutalized, the news has a tendency to take their most adolescent selves, right? Their most immature selves, that whatever they can find, and that's what they'll make public, right? So whether it be a kid who with his middle fingers up, or you know, a kid maybe smoking pot, right? I don't know, a teenager doing teenage things, and I think what happens is that creates a caricature, or even sort of a stereotype, or some sort of pigeonhole in what the victim looks like.
And your worst behavior becomes your representative behavior?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And for me, I think instead of creating that strange avatar of reality, I wanted to show that, you know, Rashad Butler, a kid who's an average student, you know, he's no straight-A student, but he's an average guy, and he's an artist, and he's an ROTC. He's got two parents in the house. He's, you know, like, he's not this stereotype. He's not this trope. And yet it still could happen to him. And that was a really big deal for me.
Standard question for any writers of fiction. I mean, how does your character's experience track with your own life, Brendan?
Well, Quinn's a lot like me in many ways. I was an athlete all through high school, and Quinn's on the basketball team. And I too, in maybe in my own personal life, I tried to record my emotional landscape by writing poems in a journal. But for Quinn, instead, it's, you know, he's coming to terms with all this and he's having conversations with friends. I mean, in many ways, it does come out of my own personal experience, trying to grapple with what it means to have some accountability to the greater community as a white person. And I think Quinn is, you know, as one person said, because I'm from Boston, which is why I think a lot of people also sometimes assume it's Springfield, Massachusetts.
Well, there are references to the Patriots in there and stuff, too.
Yeah, exactly, so, yeah. Exactly. And it's this moment where someone said, you know, Quinn's kind of a chowder head, but he has a poet's soul. And I really like that because I think it's someone who, on the outside, he's getting lots of pressure to be a kind of stereotypical all-American boy. A star athlete, a great student, someone who's taking care of his younger brother, someone who can live up to the photos of his father who were plastered around the pizza shop in town. But inside, he has an emotional core that wants to do the right thing, that wants to understand principle for what it is. And for me, I felt like I always struggled with that as a kid, and so I tried to tap into that kind of 16-year-old kid that I was back then.
And Jason, how much of Rashad is in you, or how much of you is in Rashad, I guess is the way it should go.
a lot of me is in Rashad. I mean, Rashad, I've had my own experiences with the abuse of power. I haven't been brutalized physically, but I've definitely been brutalized emotionally and psychologically by police officers, and I know what that feels like. I also know what it's like to just be a regular guy trying to live a regular life, and that life be knocked to the left or be upended, and you're 16 years old and you're trying to figure out how to deal with something that's much bigger than you and far outside of your adolescent wheelhouse. And so Rashad is very, very close to me, and even though interaction with his friends and his family is almost identical to my own, just because I wanted to make sure it was as authentic as possible, so I drew from my own gut, you know, I drew from my own pocket, and I hope it comes across.
When you say emotionally brutalized, I mean, I really still don't think that most white Americans get the idea that people make assumptions about people based on skin color, and then they, you know, think you're responsible for things when you're not.
Oh, man. I mean, you know, it's so interesting. In Brooklyn, New York, stop and frisk. In New York, stop and frisk was a big thing. And I, you know, I don't know if you know what I look like, Jeff, but I'm 6'3", and I have a whole lot of very thick hair, right? Long dreadlocks, and I've got tattoos all over me. And so, you know, I'm walking in my neighborhood, and cops stop you all the time just because they think you may have drugs. So they, you know, I'm apparently a suspect at all times. I mean, that's been going on since I was young. And it's interesting, Jeff, because now there's this big expose about police brutality, but for a lot of us, this is normal life. This is the way it's been in our communities. And so when you want to know why so many young people have so much rage or why there's such an uproar about it, it's because it isn't new. It's only new to everybody else, but it isn't new to those of us who live in these communities.
And, you know, I have to say, to add on to that, great writers like Toni Morrison and James Baldwin and Ta-Nehisi Coates have written extensively about historical trauma as it affects communities of color today. And I'm really curious, as a white man, you know, people can't experience trauma unless somebody is traumatizing them. And as a white man, I'm curious to know more about the narrative of who's delivering that trauma. You know, I would like to see that narrative written more. And I think Quinn is struggling to recognize that in All American Boys, that there can't be a Rashad without a Paul. And even though Paul, who is his hero, he's the guy who's flipping burgers at the barbecue, he's the guy who takes care of his mother when his own father dies, he's the guy who says, "I want to be a hero," to Quinn when he's young, may have to deal with something deep inside that is perpetuating this trauma in communities of color.
And Paul is the cop, the uncle. Yeah.
Thank you. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, what is Quinn's home life like then? I mean, his mom's there. Is Paul there on a regular basis? I mean, is there all the time or just once in a while?
Yeah, no, you know, this is interesting, too, because my own mother, just like Quinn's mother, worked the night shift when I was growing up so that she could make more money for the family. And Quinn's mother works the night shift to make more money. And so she's not around. Or when she is home, she has to sleep because then she has to go off to work. And so Quinn is left to take care of his younger brother, and he feels, you know, this sense of responsibility. And Paul is around often. Paul lives just down the block. And so, you know, on weekends, Quinn might take his younger brother over for a meal and they will just walk into the house. Not unlike my own experience growing up, I grew up in a neighborhood where I could just walk in and out of friends' houses, you know, and I could stay for dinner and there are no questions asked. and Quinn has to deal with that kind of a community. He has to go to those barbecues now and maybe raise some difficult questions.
Wow, which is the central point of the book, All American Boys, written by Brendan Kiley and Jason Reynolds. We'll come back and talk more with Brendan and Jason and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment of today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about a work of fiction, a young adult novel called All American Boys. It is a work of fiction, but it's about very real-world events. The central event is the beating of a black teen by a white cop. The black teen does survive, but we get to learn more about his mindset and the mindset of the white teen who witnesses the beating. And the beating is performed by somebody who is his uncle, very close to him. You can join our guests, Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley, the co-authors of the book, here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So the circumstances of Rashad's arrest and beating, Jason, there are lots of mistakes made by a couple people, and just some innocent things that happen anyway, just to kind of like a bump into people and stuff. How long and hard did you guys have to work on just this particular part of the book?
That's a good question. No one's ever asked that. That's a good question. It's interesting because there were definitely a few different iterations. The original scene was set where basically Quinn was going to have this guy go into the store to buy beer for him, and the guy was going to basically steal the beer, and when the beer came up stolen, Rashad was going to be accused of the stolen beer. I mean, it was it was way more complicated than first ever. I think we had written ourselves into a bit of a hole, and it went through a few different iterations before we landed on just a very simple, like, look, let's just have this kid get bumped and drop a bag of chips, and then there'd be an assumption. And it was Brendan who was like, look, have the police officer first check on the woman, right? Have him look at the white woman and say, ma'am, is he doing something to you, right? Because that's also a part of that scene that I think should not be forgotten, is that not only is he accused of stealing, but he's also accused of mishandling someone, which is ridiculous because the lady bumps him, as we all know in the story. So it went through a few different changes.
It ends up very elegant in its simplicity, and it's like, well, this is on, you know, this woman's down there, and this happened over, this is on the floor, and like, what happened here? And people making assumptions.
Exactly.
Right away.
And she tries to tell him, right? She tries to tell the cop
mm-hmm.
that what would happen, but no one wants to listen to anything. Right? That's the interesting part of that scene, is that the police officer doesn't want to hear anything because he's already made his mind up.
And so what does Quinn see, Brendan?
Quinn is not in the store,
right?
And this is, you know, I already hear echoes of news stories from last summer. Well, we weren't in the store, right?
Right.
But what Quinn sees is Paul is dragging Rashad out of the store. And because of that initial moment on the floor in the store, you know, what Rashad is struggling just to get up, but Paul is reading that as resisting arrest, and he sort of drags him out of the store to toss them onto the sidewalk and cuff them. And that's what Quinn witnesses. Quinn witnesses their exit and then what follows, which is, as is really, it's odd to say this, but it's beautifully described as Jason wrote it in the section of Rashad being beaten by Paul. Quinn witnesses that. He's about 20 feet away, and he sees one kid flopping around and the cop on top of him. And he doesn't really recognize Rashad, even though they go to the same school. They're not friends. So they go to a large school, so that, you know, not everyone's friends in a school of, say, you know, 500 kids graduating per class. And but then he does see Paul's face when Paul sort of looks up after having cuffed Rashad and finally sort of stabilized him on the ground. And he sees Paul's face, and what terrifies him is that this is his hero, and he sees rage on the face of his hero, and it frightens him, because I don't know if you've ever seen a photo of yourself, you know, looking mad or in a way that you don't want to see yourself. It's almost as if Quinn is looking in the mirror and saying, "Oh my God, you know, could I look like that?"
Yeah, it's a real eye-opening thing for him. And then so Jason, Rashad wakes up in the hospital, and this is a great scene. His mom wants the story, and she says, "Be completely honest." Does he know at that moment that however many times he tells it, there's going to be a lot of people outside his family who won't believe it?
You know, at that particular moment, he doesn't. Shortly after that moment, he recognizes it, though. He knows. I mean, what he knows is that his parents have prepped him for this kind of thing. He knows that his entire life, his father has been preaching to him about how to comport yourselves, himself around police officers. And because he knows the rules that his father has laid out for him, he knows that his mom is always the referee. His mom is always going to be sort of like, she's mom, mom is mom. But it's his father that he's most concerned about, because he knows that his father is going to think that the reason this happened is because Rashad broke the rules, and not that Rashad was brutalized, but that Rashad disobeyed the rules. And if only Rashad had listened to the rules, if only Rashad hadn't done whatever Rashad did, this wouldn't have happened. And I think that's a narrative that we get so often, and I wanted to make sure that I aired that out, because I think that's something that happens within the community and outside of it, for that matter. It's extra and intra, where there are people who are saying, "Well, you know, the reason this is happening is because these kids they keep robbing stores, or these kids they keep acting up, or these kids in their pants sagging, or these kids in those darn tattoos and that darn rap music, and all these things that sort of shirk the blame, right? It sort of shirks it shifts everything from victimizer to victim." And I think that's extraordinarily unfair, but it's what happens. It seems like it's what happens 9 times out of 10. It takes a whole village to convince people that this was a bad thing, that this was a victim. That, you know what I mean? It takes a village to raise a child. It also takes a village to convince everybody else that this child was brutalized.
Right. but it never seems to get down to the essence of what you're talking about, which is that, you know, what was the behavior? What actually happened here? Forget what the kid looks like or
exactly.
You know, what the suspicions are.
Even forget partially some of the behaviors, right? Because there are certain things where it's like, oh, this kid. Let's say Rashad did steal chips. Let's say he did steal a bag of chips. Did he deserve to have his ribs and his nose broken for it? Right? And I think that's the question, right? Let's say that he did. I mean, he's an unarmed teenager, and it would be a petty theft. Let's say it's true. Let's say he broke the law. He didn't, but let's say he did break the law. Does he deserve to be... Does he deserve to have a near-death experience, to almost be killed for a dollar bag of chips? And I think those are the questions that we're not asking ourselves enough, you know?
You mentioned, Brendan, about a lot of people saying, well, you know, I wasn't in the store. Did you guys consciously pick any of the details from you know, real-world cases to put in here?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's no doubt about it that, in particular, the story of Mike Brown and Darren Wilson – in Ferguson, Missouri, was a real catalyst for you know, us writing this book, as we mentioned earlier. And so, while there are some, you know, it's almost as if, I'm not sure if we were conscious, we want this to sound like that. Not that as much as it was a, you know, the details from those stories were so present in our brain at the inception of this book. It's hard not to have them in there. But also on another level, it's, we really want to do our best to do justice to these stories, to say these are not just quick news stories that come and go. We're trying to put a book on a shelf to remind us this is an issue that we must deal with or it's going to come back again and again and again. And so we want those echoes to resonate with the real life horrors, and to hopefully honor the lives of those people as well.
Yeah, I listened to your interview with Cyrus Webb, a really good job he did, and he asked a great question. How different is this story if both kids and cop are either all black or all white?
This question is an interesting one because I believe, first of all, not every officer who brutalizes a police officer is white. I think so many of them are brown people. There are black and brown police officers that perpetuate this same exact stereotype, perpetuate this same sort of abuse of power. You do not have to be a white person to perpetuate privilege and abuse and prejudice, right? So I think that's the first thing. And if the roles were reversed, the abuse of power is the abuse of power, right? I would never justify, even if it were a white kid who was brutalized, the outrage is the same. The difference, though, is that statistics show that more times than not, they are young people and people of color. And given the historical context of this country, it's really, really hard for us not to wave some red flags, you know.
We haven't gotten to the point in the story where there's video of the beating that shows up on TV. So what does that set off in Springfield, Brendan?
Well, that sets off the community hysteria in some regards, right? I mean, Jason was talking about airing things out before. Once the video is out there, the community has to react, you know. And what happens is you see teachers' reactions. You see the family around Officer Paul Galluzzo, but also all the families, like Quinn's own family, on the block who initially rallied to support him, not unlike the true story of Darren Wilson and all the people who rallied to fundraise for his legal fees. You see people reacting to the story immediately, and that's, I think, what we as writers, our role is to try to recognize the dignity of all people involved, because I don't think that I don't think anybody wakes up in the morning and is thinking about what kind of terrible evil can I do today. People who even have the best intentions, you know, end up delivering the most awful impact. And so that's the story in some regard that we have to think about. But initially, nobody wants to think about that. So instead, it's much easier to say, I'm on one side or the other. And so the community is kind of ripped apart in that way because of social media, because social media throws it in our face. And it's not a full story. It's important. It's important. We need transparency. We live in a democracy. Transparency is, I think, the backbone of any democracy. We need transparency, and social media can do that. But we have to be cautious to not jump to all kinds of conclusions right away, but to allow the story to develop and to recognize there are people involved at every level.
You talked about at the outset how you got together, began talking about this while on tour, because you needed to process the events that were going on. And again, this is even before Ferguson and Baltimore. And I wonder about tempering your own responses. I mean, John Stewart used to talk about how they'd come in the morning and be full of rage about the stuff that happened in politics, and then over the course of the day had to turn the rage into comedy. You're not trying to get to comedy here, but you're trying to make a coherent story. And I wonder about the struggle for each of you. Jason?
Well, I think for me, by the time we sat down to write the book, I had sort of processed so much of that rage. Now, the pain still exists, the rage not quite as much. So there was a lot of frustration and there was a lot of pain there. But because the rage wasn't necessarily raging at the time, I think the pain lended itself well to creating an authentic story that seemed to breathe and jump off the page. Now, had I been raging at the time, our editor would have chopped the story apart because the story would have become extraordinarily didactic and really one-sided and a little closed. I think we would have narrowed the story in had it been all emotional, mm-hmm. Which is what happens all the time, right? People get emotional and then they give you whatever their emotional perspective. They give you the emotional sliver of themselves, and I think our job was to use the rage that we were feeling, take the pain and frustration that we still felt, and create living, breathing people, whole human beings on the page.
And I'll only add to that, first of all, I really love this question. I think this is a really important question, and so thank you for it. But part of my rage, it would be a lie not to say that part of my rage is wanting to show the world, hey, look, world, I'm not Paul. Hey, look, world, I'm a white person who's not like Paul. But instead, part of the process of writing this book is me having to say, I'm not going to wag my finger at Paul as much as begin to think a little bit about my own role in all of this as well. And so for me, it's finding the whole person, as Jason was just saying, in all of those characters, and having to allow Quinn's sense of discovery be honest and not a piece of propaganda in any way. So I really admire that question a lot, because I think it's important for people like me to recognize that while we want to say things and work with our art in a way to create cultural conversation that's relevant, it doesn't mean that I escape that same criticism and scrutiny at all. So I appreciate that.
Glad you said Quinn's discovery, because I was thinking that that's one of the major themes in the book for me, is that these are not people who know the answers. They're too young to, for one thing, but right. They're willing to say, I don't know what happened, but I want to understand this better.
Which that was a big thing. And both of us were sort of like, how do you put these young people in a true position, which would be the position of uncertainty, right? More than anything else, there's just this constant, this sort of the ghost of uncertainty on both of their backs, always present in every situation that they're in. And I think that's probably a little closer to the truth than almost everything else, that most of us, especially young people, just don't know.
We are left. I want to thank you both for joining us today. Excellent work. Jason Reynolds and Brendan Kiley are the co-authors of All American Boys. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. Take care.